Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter. Pretty good Bible studies. I am now in 2 Kings chapter 19. We're going to do verses 1 through 37 today. I'm going to entitle this chapter, Hezekiah of Judah Defeats Sennacherib of Assyria. Our context is this. We're right in the middle of the siege of Jerusalem, which the aforesaid Sennacherib has begun against the city of Jerusalem. Sennacherib's on his way down to Egypt, and Jerusalem's in the way, and so he decides to take Israel on the way, so he besieges Lachish and later Libna, two cities southwest of Jerusalem, and in the process of doing that, he sends his three Assyrian officials, the Rabshakeh, the Rabsaris, and the Tartan, and they go to the walls of Jerusalem and start haranguing Hezekiah's three Hebrew officials, as well as the people who are standing on the wall watching. And Hezekiah is in a bad way. And so the ambassadors go to Hezekiah, tearing their clothes as they went, and say, and tell them what the Assyrians had said. We're going to wipe you out, Hezekiah. So that's what happened in the previous chapter. And so now we're in 2 Kings 19, verses 1 through 4. When King Hezekiah heard their report, heard the report of his three Jewish officials, he tore his clothes, covered himself with sackcloth, and went into the Lord's temple. Then Hezekiah sent Eliakim, who was in charge of the palace, Shebna the court secretary, two of the three of the aforesaid Hebrew officials, Jorah is not mentioned, I don't know why, and the leading priests who were wearing sackcloth, to the prophet Isaiah, son of Amoz. These two officials and leading priests said to Isaiah, "This is what Hezekiah says. Today is a day of distress, rebuke, and disgrace, for children have come to the point of birth, but there is no strength to deliver them. Perhaps Yahweh your God will hear all the words of the Rabshakeh, whom his master, the king of Assyria, sent to mock the living God, and will rebuke him for the words that Yahweh your God has heard. Therefore, offer a prayer for the surviving remnant." Now, a little introductory note here. This whole chapter of 2 Kings 19, verses 1 through 37, is the same, almost word for word, as Isaiah 37. The versification is off by one, I think, but it's pretty close. We're going to get to one little detail at the end of this chapter that's not in Isaiah 37, but it's almost word for word. In verse 1, Hezekiah tears his clothes, covers himself with sackcloth, which is the typical way of showing mourning, and then he goes to the temple. That's a public place, more public than Hezekiah's palace. The temple would be known to the people, and that would set an example for people to follow him, make all this public. So in front of the people, he tells Eliakim, who's the steward of his palace, and at the time, until he was later disgraced, for desiring a tomb that was too high. And Isaiah told him that God was going to roll him up like a ball and throw him away. Great prophecy from Isaiah. But Eliakim was still in charge here. And so Hezekiah sends Eliakim to go get help, to go see Isaiah, who was well known for being a spiritual type of guy. And the first thing that they're supposed to say to Isaiah is, things are so bad now, there's a day of distress, rebuke, and disgrace, for your children have come to the point of birth. But there's no delivery of the baby. And so the metaphor is this. As a woman has a lot of pain, but the pain disappears, and she's so happy when the baby comes. The Israelites are going through the pain, but they don't have the happiness of being delivered. And so Hezekiah, through his messenger, says, "Please, Isaiah, offer a prayer for the surviving remnant." Well, there's two options as to what that remnant could be. That could be the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin, who are the two tribes that are left from the 12 tribes in the south. The two tribes over which Hezekiah ruled, the other 10 tribes having been carried in captivity some time ago in 722 B.C. by Sargon II of Assyria. This is now about 701 under Sennacherib, who is Sargon's successor. And option number two as to who this remnant is, it could be the inhabitants of Jerusalem particularly, many cities of Judah having been already taken by the Assyrian king. And so the king of Judah, Hezekiah, is saying, all we've got left is a remnant here in Jerusalem. We need to get saved. I think that's probably the correct option, although I'm not sure. And by the way, when I say the 10 tribes and the 2 tribes, this is something that's kind of interesting. I'm sure the 10 tribes got their name, the northern ten tribes, because of the prophecy of Ahijah the Shilonite, who prophesied to Jeroboam II. As he tore his cloak, he said, "Look here, this cloak is torn into 10 pieces, and that's going to be your share of the kingdom." But if you count the tribes, there was 12 original tribes. Joseph had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and they counted as original tribes instead of Joseph. So that gets you up to 13. Well, Judah had the kingdom of Judah, the tribe of Judah, and the tribe of Benjamin, but they also had Simeon cities scattered around. They didn't have an actual Simeon didn't have an actual tribe that was contiguous with it, with itself, but that's three. So you take 13 minus 3, and that leaves 10 for northern Israel, and so you say, okay, well, that's fine. Well, why would you say the two tribes of Judah? Maybe I just did that because of habit. That's what people do. But there's really three, and then, well, that leaves 10 for the north, but then there's a problem because the Levites were all kicked out of the north, and they went down to the south when the kingdom split up between Jeroboam and Rehoboam in 931 B.C., so that would only leave nine tribes to the north. So I don't exactly know how you handle that, but I just know traditionally it's the northern tribes are called the 10 tribes. Well, anyway, the remnant, whoever the remnant is, Hezekiah is asking Isaiah to pray for it. We go now to 2 Kings 19, verses 5 through 7. So the servants of King Hezekiah went to Isaiah, who said to them, "Tell your master this, the Lord says, don't be afraid because of the words you have heard that the king of Assyria's attendants have blasphemed me with. I'm about to put a spirit in Sennacherib, and he will hear a rumor and return to his own land, where I will cause him to fall by the sword." Now, Sennacherib's attendants are here described as attendants. That word, the Hebrew word, is mostly translated by servants in most of the translations. Attendants here in the Holman Christian Study Bible. But the Hebrew, according to Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown, the Hebrew really signifies boys or lads or young men. And so the idea here is that Isaiah is calling the Rabsaris, the Rabshakeh, and the Tartan little boys by way of contempt. That could be. I don't know Hebrew well enough to know if that's accurate, but I'll pass it along to you. Gill and Jameson from Fawcett and Brown saying these three Assyrian ambassadors are acting a weak and childish part as well as a wicked one. And of course, the details of what they said to the three Hebrew officials is all discussed in chapter 18, the previous chapter. I can't rehash all that because it takes up a whole chapter. Now, Hezekiah tells Eliakim and Shebna, Hezekiah's messengers to Isaiah. Isaiah tells them that this is what's going to happen. Sennacherib's going to hear a rumor and return to his own land, where I will cause him to fall by the sword. Now, that did happen. There's a couple of options on what that means. If it means he will hear a rumor, that rumor would have to be translated something another way. I think the King James has blast. You will hear a blast. But it will be a report, and the report would be the total and subtle destruction of his army, which we're going to read about it in the last part of this chapter, when all of his army got killed in the middle of the night. And he will hear that report, and then he'll go back to his own land. Or it could the report could be what's recorded here in 2 Chronicles 19:9 in a couple of verses, where the text says that the king Sennacherib had heard this about Terhakah, king of Cush, king of Ethiopia. "Look, he has set out to fight against you." And so it could be that Sennacherib was worried about Ethiopia coming after him, coming after his home territory, his home base back in Assyria, back in Nineveh, and so he retreats. Either way, he did retreat. So that part of the prophecy was fulfilled, that part of Isaiah's prophecy, and also Isaiah predicted that Sennacherib would fall by the sword. Now, that actually happened, and it's interesting because it's written right down here in 2 Kings 19:35-37, which we'll get to in a minute, but it's also written in secular history. I learned about this reading Assyrian history before I realized it was here in 2 Kings. 2 Kings 19:35-37 says this: "That night the angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. When the people got up the next morning, there were all dead bodies. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, broke camp and left. He returned home and lived in Nineveh. One day, while he was worshiping in the temple of his god Nisroch, his sons Adrammelech and Sherezah struck him down with a sword and escaped to the land of Ararat. Then his son Esarhaddon became king in Sennacherib's place." And so, that's it happened, just like Isaiah predicted. He was a good prophet. We go down to now to 2 Kings 19, verse 8. When the Rabshakeh heard that the king of Assyria had left Lachish, the Rabshakeh returned and found Sennacherib fighting against Libna. And if you look at the map, Libna with a question mark is about 10 miles north, maybe 5 miles north, between 5 and 10 miles north of Lachish. And of course, they don't know exactly where it is. But apparently Lachish, either Sennacherib had already conquered Lachish and then had gone north a little bit to take care of Libna, or he had failed in his attempt to besiege Lachish and had gone forth to Libna. But that explains why his three Assyrian officials had left Jerusalem and not gone back to Lachish, but they went to Libna instead. Now, why did the three officials, the Tartan, the Rabshakeh, and the Rabsaris, why did they go back to Hezekiah? Why did they go back to Sennacherib? To give him an account of how things had gone at Jerusalem. And they needed to tell him, we can't get a direct answer from the king of Hezekiah. He won't talk with us. He won't surrender. He didn't even negotiate. He told everybody to be silent while they stand on the wall, and we yelled and screamed and hollered and got no result. So what are we supposed to do now? Now, a question might arise. Did the Rabshakeh, did he leave his army before Jerusalem? Yes, he did, because he left his other two generals, the Rabsaris and the Tartan. He left them there. We can assume that because it would be totally unreasonable for him to remove the army when Hezekiah and his people were so panicked by the besieging army. And also, we're going to see Sennacherib write a letter in response to the message he got from his three ambassadors, his three messengers. Sennacherib is going to write a letter to Hezekiah, which clearly supposes that the army is still at Jerusalem. Otherwise, his menacing letters to Hezekiah would mean nothing, because there would be no menace for Hezekiah to worry about. And besides, at the end of this chapter, we're going to read the story of the destruction of the Assyrian army. And if it's not around Jerusalem, how is it going to get destroyed? Unless, I guess, it was destroyed somewhere else, which it wasn't. So, yes, they left the army behind and went to see Sennacherib. Sennacherib is at Libna. It was somewhere in the tribe of Judah, as I said, north of Lachish. It means whiteness. It had been given to the priests, so it was a Levitical city. We go now to 2 Kings 19, verses 9 through 13. The king, that Sennacherib, had heard this about Terhakah, king of Cush, king of Ethiopia. Look, I say Ethiopia, most people think Cush is Ethiopia. Look, he, that's Terhakah of Cush, has set out to fight against you. To fight against you, Sennacherib. So Sennacherib again sent messengers to Hezekiah, saying, say this to Hezekiah, king of Judah, don't let your God, whom you trust, deceive you by promising that Jerusalem will not be handed over to the king of Assyria. Look, you have heard what the kings of Assyria have done to all the countries. They completely destroyed them. Will you be rescued? Did the gods of the nations that my predecessors destroyed rescue them? Nations such as Gozan, Haran, Rezeph, and the Edomites in Telassar? Where is the king of Hamath, the king of Arpad, the king of the city of Sepharvaim, Hena, or Iva? Well, this Terhakah, who is putting some flank pressure on our enemy Sennacherib here, Josephus calls him Tharsises, the LLX. The Septuagint calls him Thoreka. Another ancient writer calls him Tarakus. Strabo, the famous Greek geographer, calls him Megasthenes. Says he's out of Megasthenes, and he's called Tyrkon, the Ethiopian. Well, Tharsises, Thoreka, Tarakus, and Tyrkon. That just shows how hard names are to be translated from language to language. Now, this Tarakus, he could have been threatening to ally himself with Israel. In other words, to relieve Israel of its siege. Or he could have just been wanting to flank Israel completely and going up to Assyria and attack Assyria. We don't know. But whatever he was planning on doing, it caused Sennacherib to hastily send a message to Hezekiah, because he wanted Hezekiah to surrender immediately. Of course, Hezekiah didn't know about Tarakus, apparently. And so Sennacherib says to Hezekiah, don't let your God deceive you. Now, as I said, Sennacherib wanted Hezekiah to surrender immediately before Tarakus could arrive to help the Jews, or before Hezekiah got wind of Tarakus's movements even, because that would encourage Hezekiah to hold out longer. So he sends this blasphemous letter. He said, God is trying to deceive you, Hezekiah. Now, in doing that, Sennacherib outdid his Rabshakeh himself. The Rabshakeh had represented Hezekiah as a deceiver of the people. But here, Sennacherib represents God himself as a deceiver of the people. He says, Sennacherib does in verse 10, "Don't let your God deceive you." Whereas the Rabshakeh in 2 Kings 18:30 says, "Don't let Hezekiah persuade you to trust in the Lord." So this is blasphemous. Sennacherib has represented God himself as a deceiver. And then he uses the old argument, look, we beat everybody else, we're going to beat you too. And I'm sure all those names didn't mean much to you, but there are names of places, most of which have been found all over the Middle East, the ancient Near East. Now, in our last chapter, we talk about Gozan. That's where the river Chabor runs into the Euphrates River. That area, that intersection is called Gozan. Haran is where Abraham came from to get into the Promised Land. It's further northeast into Syria. It's on the river Balik, which runs, it's a big tributary of the Euphrates River that runs due north and south. Now, Rezeph, we didn't mention last chapter. According to my BibleAtlas.org map, if you at Haran and you go south until the Balik River runs into the Euphrates River, and then right across the river a little bit to the south and west is Rezeph. But it's got a question mark, so they don't really know where that is, but I'm sure it's somewhere over there. Now, also in this message to Hezekiah, Sennacherib mentions the Edenites and Telassar as having been conquered by him. The Edenites, well, that sounds like the Garden of Eden. So let me read you this. Jameson Fawcett Brown says, there's an ancient village north of Baghdad called Adna, which is close to Eden. Some people think Eden is the name of a region of Mesopotamia in which there was paradise. John Gill says Eden was also in Mesopotamia, in the eastern part of which was the Garden of Eden. Of course, that's all speculation. Nobody knows where the Garden of Eden was. I assume it was in Mesopotamia somewhere. Here's what Wikipedia says. Eden's location remains the subject of controversy and speculation among some Christians. There are hypotheses that locate Eden at the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates in Iraq or Mesopotamia, Africa, and the Persian Gulf, which is right around there if you go south a little bit. Among others, though, some Christians see it as metaphorical. Well, that's liberal Christians. We don't count them. Wikipedia continues, some Christians even believe that Eden existed in North America before the separation of the continents. That's a good one. Haven't heard that, but let's just assume that it's the Garden of Eden somewhere in Mesopotamia. And so Sennacherib is bragging about people who have been living in that same area. He calls them the Edenites and Telassar. Well, BibleAtlas.org has Telassar as Susa, which is a very famous place, the ruins of which are still there, I understand. It's where Daniel finished out his career when he was working for the Persians. It's right across the Tigris River to the east, right down there near the head of the Persian Gulf. And so if Eden is in Mesopotamia and Telassar is Susa, some people from Susa must have migrated over to Eden. I don't know. It's all interesting speculation. But the point is that Sennacherib's beaten all these people. He then goes on to mention verse 13, where is the king of Hamath? That's in Phoenicia. And Hamath is on the Orontes River between the Lebanon and anti-Lebanon range. The king of Arpad is just a few miles north of the famous Syrian city of Aleppo, as you head over toward the Mediterranean coast. And then the king of the city of Sepharvaim, that's on the Tigris River, south of Asher, and Asher south of Nineveh. And it's got a question mark, too, on the map. And then the last two that are mentioned, Hena or Iva, according to BibleAtlas.org, that's the same place, actually, on the Euphrates River, right south of where the Chabor River intersects the Euphrates River. And then the last place that's mentioned is, well, actually, it's not mentioned here, but Hena Iva in a previous chapter is also called Ava. So anyway, you can see here that Sennacherib and his predecessors had wiped out a whole bunch of nations. Now, of course, the people in the ancient Near East assumed that a local god protected a locality, and when the locality was beaten, that means that the god was beaten and that he was no good. And so Sennacherib is wrongly thinking that Yahweh, the local god, and I put that in quotation marks, the local god of Jerusalem is not going to protect Jerusalem. So he's just trying to scare Hezekiah by reciting his previous success. We go down to 2 Kings 19, verses 14 through 19. Hezekiah took the letter from the hand of the Assyrian messengers, read it, and then went up to the Lord's temple and spread it out before the Lord. Then Hezekiah prayed before the Lord, Lord God of Israel, who is enthroned above the cherubim, you are God, you alone of all the kingdoms of the earth. You made the heavens and the earth. Listen closely, Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, Lord, and see. Hear the words that Sennacherib has sent to mock the living God. Lord, it is true that the kings of Assyria have devastated the nations in their lands. They have thrown their gods into the fire, for they were not gods, but made by human hands, wood and stone. So they have destroyed them. The Assyrians have destroyed those gods. Now, Lord our God, please save us from his hands so that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you are the Lord God, you alone. And of course, what Hezekiah is saying here is, yes, he's right. Sennacherib is right that these local gods have all been destroyed. But you, Yahweh, are not a local God. And by the way, every time I said Lord, that's capitalized Lord as Yahweh. He was saying Yahweh, Yahweh, Yahweh. Please deliver me. Now, in verse 14, Hezekiah has spread the letter before the Lord. The Lord was referring to the temple. And, of course, Hezekiah was in the courtyard. He's not allowed to go into the temple proper. Only the priests were allowed to do that, as the commentator Poole says. He spreads the letter out not so that Yahweh could be apprised of the contents of the letter. Of course not. Yahweh is omniscient. He doesn't need to have the letter open to him so that Yahweh can read the letter. But it was to show to Hezekiah's people that this matter was in the hands of Yahweh. He's delivering the letter to Yahweh saying, I've got a problem, Yahweh. Here it is. Great application point here. You got a problem, spread it out before the Lord and let him tell you what to do about it. I assume he spread it on the dirt right there in the temple courtyard, except there was no dirt in the temple courtyard. That's the tabernacle. In fact, I recall that in the construction of the temple, if I remember correctly, the biblical text actually described what the courtyard was covered with, some kind of wood of some sort. I could be wrong. I'm going from memory. Now, notice that when Hezekiah got this blasphemous, obnoxious, threatening letter, he didn't turn around and start railing at Sennacherib, either to messengers to go back to Sennacherib and start yelling at Sennacherib, or just in front of his ministers. He wasn't like Pope Sixtus V when Sixtus V was trying to figure out how to save France for the Catholic Church. And when anybody went to see him, he would start ranting and raving and hollering and screaming until he finally croaked from all the pressure. No, Hezekiah didn't do that. He just turns to God. In verse 15 in this prayer, he says, you, Yahweh, are God alone of all the kingdoms of the earth. In other words, not all these little petty gods that Sennacherib is referring to. No. You're God of all of these places. You are the God of Gozan, Haran, Rezeph, Eden, and Telassar, Hamath, Arpad, Sepharvaim, Hena, and Iva. You're the God of all that. So he acknowledges Yahweh for who he is, and Yahweh blessed him. Helped him survive a very, very difficult time in his life and in the life of Judah. In verse 19, Hezekiah says, God, if you'll save us from this, all the kings of the earth will know that you're the Lord God. So again, this is for the glory of God, not just for Jerusalem. Now notice that Hezekiah is praying for something that has already been prophesied to him, deliverance. Back in verses 5 and 6 of this chapter, when Hezekiah had sent Eliakim and Shebna to Isaiah. Isaiah had replied to those two. He says, tell your master Hezekiah this. The Lord says, don't be afraid because of the words you have heard that the king of Assyria's attendants have blasphemed me with. And then he basically says, Isaiah says, is that you're going to be delivered. I will put a spirit in him so that he will hear a rumor and return to his own land. And then I will make him fall by the sword in his own land. So that's already been prophesied, but Hezekiah prays anyway, and that is a good lesson to learn. Just because God has told you something, just because it's been revealed in the Word, that doesn't mean it has been effected in your life, and you need to pray about it, and pray hard, fervently. We go now to 2 Kings 19, verses 20 through 24. Then Isaiah, son of Amoz, sent a message to Hezekiah. The Lord, the God of Israel, says, I have heard your prayer. Now, this is not the first message. We've already talked about one message that he sent back by Eliakim and Shebna. This is another message. And this message says this: The Lord, the God of Israel, says, I have heard your prayer to me about Sennacherib, king of Assyria. This is the word the Lord has spoken against him. Virgin daughter Zion despises you and scorns you. Daughter Jerusalem shakes her head behind your back. Who is it you mocked and blasphemed? Against whom have you raised your voice and lifted your eyes in pride? Against the Holy One of Israel. You have mocked the Lord through your messengers. You have said, with my many chariots, I have gone up to the heights of the mountains, to the far recesses of Lebanon. I cut down its tallest cedars, its choice cypress trees. I came to its farthest outpost, its densest forest. I dug wells, and I drank foreign waters. I dried up all the streams of Egypt with the soles of my feet. So this message that Isaiah sent to Hezekiah is basically a quotation of what God is speaking against Sennacherib, and is not pleasant. In verse 21, God accuses Sennacherib of being despised by virgin daughter Zion. Well, Zion, of course, is Mount Zion, is Jerusalem. Became a symbol for all Israel, actually, and now it's a symbol of the whole new Israel, the church. But Zion is called a virgin daughter. Why? Because Jerusalem had never been forced, never been taken. And so calling Zion a virgin is telling Sennacherib, it's a vain thing for you to try to take Jerusalem and to rape Jerusalem, because God, who is the father of this virgin, would carefully keep her from such a rape. And this virgin daughter Zion despises you, Sennacherib, shakes her head behind your back. That is apparently something cultural. If you want to show contempt to somebody, go behind them and shake their head to show derision. Verse 23, this message from Isaiah to Hezekiah says this about Sennacherib: You have mocked the Lord through your messengers. The messengers, of course, are the Rabshakeh, the Rabsaris, and the Tartan that were sent to Jerusalem in the previous chapter. You have said, Sennacherib, God continues to relay the message to the Assyrians through the message he's sending from Isaiah to Hezekiah. You have said, Sennacherib, with my many chariots, I have gone up to the heights of the mountains, to the far recesses of Lebanon, and cut down the tall cedars. Now, what's he talking about there? Well, he had crossed many mountains to get to Jerusalem. If you look at the map, there are a lot of mountains you have to go through. They always came from the northeast, from Assyria and Media, from that area, from Mesopotamia. They would always come from the northeast to get down to Jerusalem. Jerusalem itself was surrounded by mountains. And Sennacherib is said to have cut down many trees in Lebanon. Why? Well, to open the way for his army to get through, to support himself with materials for the siege of Jerusalem, to make shelters with that wood, to have a place for his soldiers to lie in, to make wooden fortresses from which to annoy Jerusalem, whatever, just for military purposes. You've done all that. You dug wells and drank foreign waters. Of course, they have to dig wells as they go to get water. And they dried up all the streams of Egypt with the soles of my feet. And there's a couple of ways you can take that. Here's option number one. As soon as Sennacherib's vast infantry marched into a region, soles of my feet marched into a region, the streams were drunk up by them. So you have drunk up the streams of Egypt by marching into Egypt with your soldiers. And as soon as the soldiers put their soles of the feet on the ground, they also had to lean down and drink water out of the streams of Egypt, and you dried them up, speaking a little bit in an exaggerated fashion. Or it could be the rivers were dried up because they provided no obstruction to the onward march of his armies as they headed toward Egypt. Now, this mention of Egypt in verse 24 presents a problem, because Sennacherib never made it to Egypt. I just checked his Wikipedia article to make sure that he never made it to Egypt, and no, he never did. So let's look at a couple of options, exactly what's being referred to here when Isaiah says that Sennacherib is saying, I, Sennacherib, dried up all the streams of Egypt. How did he do that with the soles of his feet? How did he do that if he never got there? Well, this is one option I thought of. It's probably not the correct option, but this is what I came up with here. Egypt, as we know, was allied with Hezekiah, and Egypt had come up into Israel to try to help Egypt's ally Hezekiah, and had gotten beaten by Sennacherib and the Assyrians. And thus, you could say the streams of Egypt provided no opposition. A stream usually blocks an army. Well, the streams of Egypt, if they were streams that in Egypt, as Egypt went up into Israel, then those streams did not metaphorically block the Assyrians from conquering the Egyptians. I know that's a little weak, but it's an idea. Let me read you what Wikipedia says about this. Quote, the Assyrians began by taking Ashkelon and defeating Sidkiya. Ashkelon's on the coast of Israel in Gaza. Then they besieged and took numerous cities. As the Assyrians were preparing to take Ekron, again, one of the five famous cities of the Philistines that was to the west of Jerusalem, as the Assyrians were preparing to take Ekron, Hezekiah's ally, Egypt, intervened in the conflict. The Assyrians defeated the Egyptian expedition in a battle near the city of Elteka. That's a Jewish city. They took the cities of Ekron and Timnah, and Judah stood alone. The Assyrians took Ekron and Timnah, with Sennacherib setting his sights on Jerusalem. And so the idea here is that Egypt provided no opposition, and so the way you express that metaphorically is the streams of Egypt provided no opposition. We marched right through them. I don't think that's what it is. I think the best way to explain this is, as Colin Delitzsch does, that Sennacherib here is speaking of his intended conquest of Egypt. And backing him up is the New American Standard Bible note on the translation, which says the Masoretic text has it in the future. The Masoretic text says, will dry up. And there's other translations that also have it in the future. The American Standard Version, God's Word, the Revised Version, they translate it in the future. So what Hezekiah is saying, that Sennacherib is saying, is, I will dry up all the streams of Egypt with the soles of my feet. In which case, he's just bragging, but he never got around to doing it because he had to retreat back to Nineveh. We go now to 2 Kings 19, verses 25 through 28. Again, Isaiah is now putting words into the mouth of Sennacherib in his message back to Hezekiah. Yahweh is now speaking to Sennacherib. Have you not heard, Sennacherib? I designed it long ago. Designed what? All of your conquests that you're bragging about. I planned it in days gone by. I have now brought it to pass, and you have crushed fortified cities into piles of rubble. Their inhabitants have become powerless, dismayed, and ashamed. They are plants of the field, tender grass on the rooftops, blasted by the east wind. But I know you're sitting down, Sennacherib. I know you're going out and you're coming in and you're raging against me, because you're raging against me and your arrogance have reached my ears. I will put my hook in your nose and my bit in your mouth. I will make you go back the way you came, back to Assyria, back to Nineveh. Will God ask Sennacherib in this message from Isaiah to Hezekiah? Sennacherib is being made to speak, and God is speaking to Sennacherib, and God says, have you not heard, Sennacherib? Well, how could Sennacherib have heard that God was the author of all of Sennacherib's success? It's a rhetorical question, I'm sure. John Gill suggests it's because Sennacherib should have known by reading the history of ancient times or by means of a prophet somehow. I don't think so. I think that God is just asking a rhetorical question here. Look here, Sennacherib. You are such a braggadocious moron. You talk about all your fortified cities that you crushed into piles of rubble. Well, guess what? I brought it to pass. I did it. I had my reasons for doing that, because God often uses sinful people for rods of punishment. And yes, you took cities and made them plants of the field, tender grass. Tender grass is grass that's not deeply rooted. It's baby grass. It's easy to pluck. Grass on the rooftops, I guess they had dirt on their rooftops where grass would grow. Blasted by the east wind. The wind would come from the east, which is that big desert, the Arabian desert, to the east of Jerusalem. Bad Sirocco, I think they called it. Really bad hot winds. That's all of what you did, Sennacherib. But hey, you have blasphemed me. You have raged against me. You have been arrogant against me. So I'm going to put a hook in your nose and a bit in your mouth like a horse, a hook in your nose like an oxen, and I'm going to jerk you around and pull you back to, like some kind of an animal, back to Assyria. Commentators have speculated as to exactly what the metaphor is here. Some have said it's a hook into a large unruly fish, a leviathan or the great whale, or the way you put a hook into a bear or to a buffalo, except I don't think they had buffaloes back then, but somebody suggested that, or the way you put a bit into a horse or mule, and that's probably what he was referring to. But at any rate, the point is God's got the power to restrain the Assyrian like a dumb beast. We go now to 2 Kings 19:29, and now in this message from Isaiah to Hezekiah, the words are now going to refer to Yahweh speaking to Israel or speaking to Hezekiah. This will be the sign for you, says God to Hezekiah. This year you will eat what grows on its own, and in the second year what grows from that. But in the third year, sow and reap, plant vineyards, and eat their fruit. So in other words, the sign that Hezekiah is going to see is there's no more troops around here, and we can plant crops. God is talking about here, you will eat what grows on its own. That's talking about volunteer growth. Why would there be volunteer growth that they had to eat? Well, because the Assyrian army had either eaten up all the standing crops or destroyed the fields so they couldn't plant any more crops. And plus, they were out there, so they couldn't plant crops. And so they had to eat volunteer growth. Now, there is a question as to why the volunteer growth stretched over the period of 2 years instead of just one. Well, here's option one. This is from the pulpit commentary. The first year is the year that Sennacherib approached, and the Judahites couldn't plant because of Sennacherib's troops. Well, then Sennacherib's troops withdraw, and when that happens, the Judahites eat volunteer growth in the first year. So in the first year, they eat without planting and sowing and reaping, but then the second year, they don't plant and reap that year either, and the pulpit commentary speculates that that's because it's a sabbatical year. Every 7 years, they weren't supposed to plant and reap. So they're eating volunteer growth for 2 years, but in the third year, as verse 29 says, the Israelites can sow, the Judahites can sow and reap. Well, that's option number one, is how do you explain these first 2 years before the third year of sowing and reaping? Well, option number two is the first year, Sennacherib arrives in the autumn, thus disturbing the planting. The Israelites can't plant the crops. And so the Israelites don't plant, and they now have to then eat volunteer growth. I don't know how they eat volunteer growth when the Assyrian army is still there, keeping them from going out and picking. Kalandelits don't mention that. And then Kalandelits say in the second year, Sennacherib stays all the way until the next autumn of the second year and disturbs the planting again. So for the first 2 years, the Israelites don't plant and reap, but in the third year, they do. The problem with that is that the verse here in verse 29 says, this year you will eat what grows on its own. And in the second year, you'll eat what grows from that. So that means in the first 2 years, they're eating volunteer growth. They can't plant, but they eat volunteer growth. Well, how do they get the volunteer growth? How do they go out and get it when they're locked up in the city? I don't know. Kalandelis doesn't answer that for me. I think the first option, the pulpit commentator's option, is much better. The first year, Sennacherib approaches, messes up the planting. Sennacherib's army leaves. The Judahites have been messed up by planting, but the army's gone now, so they can eat volunteer growth in the year of the attack, 701 B.C. But then after that, the second year is a sabbatical year. We go now to 2 Kings 19, verses 30 through 31. God is still talking to Hezekiah through the message from Isaiah to Hezekiah. The surviving remnant of the house of Israel will again take root downward and bear fruit upward. For a remnant will go out from Jerusalem and survivors from Mount Zion. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. Now the remnant, I think I mentioned this earlier, there's two options. It could be the remnant that escaped from Sennacherib's invasion of the fortified cities of Judah, like Timnah, like Libnah, like Lachish. And so those survivors will then prosper, take root downward and bear fruit upward. And these people would be those people who had fled from those cities and flown to Jerusalem for protection. Because it says in verse 31, for a remnant will go out from Jerusalem and survivors. And so that remnant that leaves Jerusalem is those who survive from the attack, those in the hinterland. Or you could just take remnant to refer to the two tribes of Judah left after the 10 northern tribes had been taken away in 722, 21 years or so earlier. Well, whoever it is, verse 31, this remnant that goes out from Jerusalem from Mount Zion, they break out from the city. They leave the walled-in city when the Assyrian troops leave. And then they take root downward and bear fruit upward. They're going to prosper. Of course, a plant does that. It doesn't really bear fruit unless it first sends root downward. And so the fruit upward on the plant prospers because of the plants having taken root in the soil. So this is good news from Isaiah to Hezekiah. We go now to 2 Kings 19, verses 32 through 34. Yahweh continues speaking to Hezekiah concerning Sennacherib. Therefore, this is what the Lord says about the king of Assyria. He will not enter this city or shoot an arrow there or come before it with a shield or build up an assault ramp against it. He will go back on the road that he came, and he will not enter this city. This is the Lord's declaration. I will defend this city and rescue it for my sake and for the sake of my servant David. So here basically Yahweh says, Jerusalem's not going down. I'm going to save it. I'm going to defend it for my sake and for the sake of my servant David. Notice that the city was not saved for its own sake. It was saved for the preservation of the messianic line for my servant David. It was saved so that the Messiah could be born there. And of course, when we're talking about Zion, we should focus on Jesus and his church, not Jerusalem, not the physical city. We go now to 2 Kings 19, verses 35 through 37, and we'll finish this chapter. That night, the angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. When the people got up the next morning, there were all those dead bodies. There were all the dead bodies. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, broke camp and left. He returned home and lived in Nineveh. One day, while he was worshiping in the temple of his god Nisroch, his sons Adrammelech and Sharezer struck him down with the sword and escaped to the land of Ararat. Then Sennacherib's son Esarhaddon became king in his place. Now it happened at night when these 185,000 people were killed. That detail is left out in Isaiah 37:36. That parallel passage which I said was almost word for word the same, but that little detail is left out. In verse 35, it says, the people got up the next morning. Well, what people? Well, it could be the survivors of Sennacherib's army, as Colin Delitzsch say. They got up and saw 185,000 of their comrades stiff. Or it could just be when the Jews got up the next morning. They looked out over the walls and there's 185,000 dead bodies. Now, where'd that number come from? I guess they counted. I guess the Jews counted the dead bodies after the Assyrian army left. Now, of course, the first question that we ask is, how did they die? Well, I think it was some kind of plague myself. Josephus says that too. He says it was a pestilential disease. Well, if so, the disease would still have to be miraculous because everyone died in their sleep without awakening anyone else. As the pulpit commentary says, no normal plague wipes out 185,000 people in one night. In other words, this would have to be a bodacious plague. Ellicott mentioned some other commentators have suggested a lightning storm killed them. No, how can a lightning storm wipe out 185,000 people in one night, for one thing? And how could it do it without waking anybody else up? The people didn't find out till they got up the next morning. That's not it. Pulpit commentary mentioned some people say it was a nocturnal attack by Tirhaka of Cush, Ethiopia. They attacked in the night and killed 185,000 people. Well, how can that be? An attack would have wakened everybody up. But the text says they didn't discover till they got up the next morning, not in the middle of the night when they would have heard it if there had been an attack. So that's not it. So I assume it's a disease of some sort. It says the angel of the Lord did it. Again, supernatural agency behind natural processes. That happens a lot. I don't understand the connection really between the supernatural and natural at this point. Angel of the Lord usually means Jesus. In the Old Testament, can't prove it, but it usually probably means Jesus the second. Of course, he wasn't called Jesus at this time. He was the second person of the Trinity, the Son. At any rate, Sennacherib heads home, and Sennacherib eventually meets an unhappy end back in Nineveh. But before we talk about that, let's see what happened after the siege ended in Israel, in Judah. Here's what Wikipedia says, quote, despite the seemingly inconclusive end to the blockade of Jerusalem, the Levantine campaign was largely an Assyrian victory. After the Assyrians had seized many of Judah's most important fortified cities and destroyed several towns and villages, Hezekiah realized that his anti-Assyrian activities had been disastrous military and political miscalculations, and as such submitted to the Assyrians once more. He was forced to pay a heavier tribute than previously, probably along with a heavy penalty, and the tribute that he had failed to send to Nineveh from 705 to 701 B.C., he was also forced to release the imprisoned king of Ekron named Pati, and Sennacherib granted substantial portions of Judah's land to the neighboring kingdoms of Gaza, Ashdod, and Ekron. Those are Philistine kingdoms. And of course, this might have come from, probably did come from Assyrian sources, which are biased. But at any rate, at least Jerusalem wasn't conquered. Now, verse 36 says, Sennacherib returned to Nineveh from wherever he was. He wasn't in front of Jerusalem, but from whatever Judahite city he was besieging, he heads back to Nineveh. Now, how long did he stay there? Jameson Fawcett Brown says, for about 20 years after his disaster, according to the inscriptions. The word dwelt is consistent with any indefinite length of time he dwelt in Nineveh. Nineveh, so called from Ninus, that is Nimrod, its founder, his name means exceedingly impious rebel. He subverted the existing patriarchal order of society by setting up a system of chieftainship founded on conquest. The hunting field was his training school for war. He was of the race of Ham and transgressed the limits marked by God. This is all in Genesis 10. He encroached on Shem's portion. He abandoned Babel for a time after the miraculous confusion of tongues and went and founded Nineveh. Nimrod founded Nineveh. And he was, after his death, worshipped as Orion, the constellation. Kind of interesting backstory on the capital city of Nineveh, which, by the way, the remains of which are in Mosul in present-day Iraq. Now, one day, Sennacherib was worshipping in the temple of his god Nisroch. Jameson Fawcett Brown said that Nisr in Semitic means eagle. The termination Ak means great, so it's a great eagle he was worshipping. The eagle-headed human figure in Assyrian sculptures is no doubt Nisroch. You've seen those pictures everywhere. Nisroch is the same as Asher. Jameson Fawcett Brown continue. Asher was the chief Assyrian god. The corresponding goddess was Ashir or Astarte. She shows up everywhere. Now, Sennacherib's sons cut him down while he's worshipping. Adramelech and Sherezer, I've read that story in the Syrian history. It's all in the tablets. I don't remember the details of it, but it's a famous story. It's also here in the scriptures, too. Why did they do it? It's not known why the parricide was committed, but there was a story that was noised about among the Jews, is that Sennacherib wanted to know why God fought for the Jews so hard after his troubles at Jerusalem and failure to take the city. So someone told Sennacherib, well, the reason the Jews fight so hard is because Abraham offered his son to be killed, and Yahweh was very happy with that, and so he fights for the Jews. Well, it says that the two sons of Sennacherib heard that Sennacherib had been told that success comes from killing a son, and they were sons, and they thought, maybe we better take some preemptive action here and kill him before he kills us. That's an interesting story. Who knows whether it's true? It's probably not. The Jews are very, shall we say, creative in their literature. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished 2 Kings chapter 19. We are prepared now to go to chapter 20 in our next audio. In chapter 20, Hezekiah will get sick, will get well, and then he will expose all of his, or God's, earthly treasures to the Babylonians, which is bad because the Babylonians soon came and took all that stuff away in 586 BC. So we'll see Hezekiah's reign end in our next chapter. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.